This is Circulating Ideas. I'm Steve Thomas. My guest today is Steve O'Connor. He's an international speaker, workshop presenter, editor, writer, consultant, and librarian. His latest book is Library Management in Disruptive Times. He's also a longstanding journal editor of Library Management and Library Management China. Circulating Ideas is brought to you with support from the University of South Carolina School of Library and Information Science and from listeners like you. Steve, welcome to the show and thank you for being on Circulating Ideas.
It's a pleasure to be here.
I know we've been trying for quite a while to get this conversation together, and I'm glad we finally did across time zones, across days and everything. So,
yes, I think I've been very fortunate getting the right end of this time equation. Because as I look outside, it's nice and sunny, although it's been quite cool this morning.
Yeah, and for me, it's dark outside, and I'm going to finish up this conversation, take the dog out for a walk, and go to bed. I wanted to start out with kind of a question that I ask a lot of our guests now, and it might be a little bit different for you being, most of my guests are American, so it's nice to get a different perspective sometimes. What was your path to librarianship? Like, how did you become interested in libraries in the first place when you're first going through school and things like that, and you were considering careers?
Mine was dictated to some extent by circumstance, in that I'd finished school and was going to university. Then my father passed away, and so I needed a scholarship to continue. And I was offered two scholarships, one to be a school teacher and one to be a librarian. And I knew I didn't want to be a school teacher, being a librarian had the attractions. And so I fell into it. And the more I remained in it, the more I enjoyed it. And at this stage, it's been a fantastic career, because I've been able to travel the world and to try and make a difference to people's lives with the provision of books and information, and to try and help them navigate their way through the galaxy or the galaxy of information to what they require for their needs. I think there are two requirements to be a good librarian. And one is that you have to like travel. And I certainly like travel. And the second is you've got to be able to spend a lot of money. And I certainly have spent a lot of money, in the university libraries I've worked with. And I've been a university librarian in Australia. I've been the CEO of a library consortia in Australia, providing all kinds of training, cataloguing in 80 languages, and storage of materials, a 3 million volume storage facility of low-use materials. And then working as a university librarian in Hong Kong and being able to learn a lot more about a different culture, because I found it really curious and interesting that all the presumptions you have about running a library in a particular location where you've been in a particular culture, they're mostly all questioned again when you move into a different culture, in this case a Chinese culture, in this case a language speaking Chinese. But I didn't have any idea that people in Hong Kong couldn't really talk to people in the mainland, because of the difference between Cantonese and Putonghua or Mandarin. And so being able to live in Hong Kong and understand their culture and understand how to manage in Hong Kong a library is very, very different to managing a library in Australia. Or in my experience, I've worked, as I've indicated, I worked with Solinet as it became Lyrisis in Atlanta a number of years ago. And so the cultures were not all that different, but once you move into Asia and Southeast Asia in particular, it becomes quite different. And it begins to affect, the way in which you view your actions and how you want to achieve a particular objective. the Chinese have a wonderful phrase talking about the future. They said, talk about Wei Lai Tushuguam, you know, the future of libraries. And that has been a focus for me in my career for a long, long time. And I'd like to talk a little bit about that as we go through and review this book that I've been fortunate enough to edit.
Yeah, I did want to kind of start with that too. Of, do you see a difference in the kinds of, because the book that you've written, we're going to talk about mostly, is Library Management in disruptive Times. Have you found that libraries throughout the world are encountering these same disruptive times? I mean, is it sort of the internet and various economies crashing and stuff around the world that's disrupting libraries? I mean, is it the same kind of disruption in Australia versus the US versus China?
No, it's quite different, I think, and the rates of change are quite different. Libraries in Australia, university libraries in particular, their budget mix of, you know, print versus digital changed quite a number of years ago, and now the digital content would be sitting around 93-94%. So of their budget content, they would be spending, say, 93-94% on digital as opposed to print. Whereas if you go to a country like Thailand, or certainly China, the mix would be very, very different. You know, you'd be lucky to be getting around the 50-60% spent on digital. And I think even in the States, the percentage spent on digital is less. It's picking up now, but it used to be around the 70-80%. So, and to some extent, that's not the library. It's the users and what their demands are and what medium, if you like, they want to look at materials. And so that's an interesting way of looking at it, but it really reflects the way in which people look at change in a library and a library system. So the disruptive effects, I think, are getting worse now because of the financial crisis, but that's not true disruption, I suppose. But the way in which the libraries are changing their business model, that's what fascinates me. And certainly in Hong Kong, that is changing, but in a Chinese culture, the reverence for authority or for the luoshi, the teacher, is very, very powerful. It's lessening now, but it's still very powerful as a cultural influence in the culture, but also in the library. Whereas in China, that reverence is still very strong. And the number of university libraries, which are really up there, if you like, in terms of being powerful libraries, is very, very small, probably, you know, 10 or 12 across the whole country. And when you look at the population of China, what is it, 1.3 billion?
Right.
And they have probably well over 1,000 universities. They've got a chance to leap from one position to the next, but the funds and the approach to differences in information are quite different, and also the language differences there. So the way in which people deal with disruption, I think, is probably the greatest limiting factor, because we all conditioned to think that we need to do our strategic planning, and we sit down for a day and do our strategic planning and come out with a plan for the next 5 years at the end of the day. And, you know, if we think that's working well, then I think we've got a rude awakening, because you don't have one future. None of us have one future. We all have multiple futures. And it's a matter of keeping alive those multiple futures for yourself, but in this case, for the libraries, you know, in terms of what could you possibly do? How could you possibly change the business model for a library? And, of course, there are many ways of doing that. And those who allow themselves to come up with a plan in one day are very much limiting themselves to just an extension of the past. But if you really want to look at the future, you look further into the past, because you can then begin to see the various options you've got for radical change, for moderate change, or, you know, no change at all. And people steer away from the radical change But it's ironic, I think, Steve, that the radical change is turning out to be the normal change now. Who could have predicted a few years ago that the internet would have been such a vital tool for transmitting content for libraries across the globe? And it is. I can remember when I was doing planning when I was at UTS in Sydney. And we made the real bet then that the internet would be a transmitting device for digital content. And so we predicated all our planning on that basis for the next 5 years at that stage. And it turned out to be a very good punt. And so we were ready. We had policies in place, to allow us to move, to that particular situation very much quicker. But I think for the most part, we have a fairly conservative profession. We have some wonderful people in our profession, but I think they're predominantly conservative in terms of how they deal with the structure and the way in which a library can and should be organized. I think that is changing, but it's certainly we need to look at the future. And that's why I sat down a couple of years ago and I wrote a book with a friend of mine, Peter Sidorko, on scenario planning, trying to inculcate in people the way in which you could look at the future and come up with multiple futures, the way in which you could engage your users looking at those multiple futures and get some agreement from your users as to which way to go in terms of the library setting up a future. So I think our profession is such a vital one. It's one I'm totally committed to. But I'm really in my role as the editor of library management and in writing these books, it is really to try and challenge people to think about things they don't think about. You know that phrase, and if you begin to think about things that you don't think about, you're starting to think about the things you should think about. And it's a mixed phrase, but we often don't allow ourselves to think about things that we should be thinking about because we don't have enough money, we don't have enough staff, we don't have enough resources, we need a new building or a new system or whatever that is. But if you allow yourself to think about that, and if you allow yourself to put in place a plan which is going to, require differences, then you can start to garner a lot of support, political support, leadership support, for a very different library. It may not get there immediately, but you'll have a vision, you'll have a future, and you'll have your users supporting that future. And you'll have a staff who become empowered by that future, who, they believe in the end that you can actually do it. And in my experience, you invariably do it. It might be slightly different to what you planned, but you've begun to deliver a future which you hadn't been game to think about before.
And you said you've written the book on the scenario planning and you've done a lot of consulting work on that. Do you find that the staff you work with are open to your ideas of doing this planning? Like they're open to the change?
Yes, I think yes and no. When I was in Hong Kong, I had a staff of I think about 150, and a very heavily populated general grade staff. A lot of them were doing reshelving and other duties around the library, and what they didn't understand was why the reshelving was dropping off, the loans were dropping off, and so we sat down and we did a whole day just talking about that kind of thing, and they didn't see the connection between books and the arrival of the digital content. And really, we talked about that, we saw the future of the library as being in the delivery of content via digital means. A lot of them believed that the academic staff came to the library every day, as they had for years and years and years. But we did some surveys and demonstrated very clearly that they weren't. And so, by not dismissing their concerns and by indicating that there would be no redundancies, but there would be retraining, we retrained a lot of staff into different roles. Now, some people didn't like that, and some people did leave, but a lot of people embraced the new future. And because they began to see it rather than being told what the plan was going to be without exploring it with them. So I think it's, you know, it's critically important to be able to sit down with them. But in my experience, mostly people will engage with their future if you give them the chance to discuss it, debate it, the more that they can see it, you know, kick the tires, so to speak. They'll, you know, want to get on board of that new car because the tires are solid, it's got a good engine in it, and it's got prospects for getting up the road.
Well, before we get too much into the Library Management and Disruptive Times books, I did want to ask about your being editor of Library Management, the journal, and Library Management China. How did you get started with that?
Oh, Steve, I was an accidental editor. accidental in so many ways. I was working in Perth at the time, and a colleague there, Patricia Lazel Ward, you know, who's an academic, she was retiring, and she said, would I be interested? And I thought, and we talked about it, what it entailed. And I said, oh, yeah. I thought, I've always been interested in ideas and how ideas can change. And so I was asked to be an editor, and I hadn't really planned for it, but that was 15, 16 years ago now. And I've been the editor of Library Management since then. When I was living in Hong Kong, I saw the need to try and build a bridge between the publications in the West, so to speak, and in China. And so I talked Emerald into starting a journal called Library Management China, which was completely in Putonghua, you know, the language of the simple people. And we took a really good paper from the Library Management Journal in English, and we translated it into Chinese. And we took the best paper we could find in our journal in Chinese, and we translated it into English. And so we built a bridge between the two. And that worked very successfully, I think, for a number of years. And so being an editor of a journal like Library Management really gets you into all parts of the world because you get authors coming from everywhere and you get to see those kind of things. But you also get a chance to pursue particular topics. One topic I've got coming up shortly is to... I've commissioned papers, about 10, 12 papers, based on people's response to the quotation by your third president. He was third, I think, Thomas Jefferson. And he is reputed to have said that information is the currency of democracy. Information is the currency of democracy. I don't think he really said it, but that was certainly what he had in mind. And different people around the world are interpreting that phrase, you know, very, very differently. You know, South Africans have one particular view, British, and, you know, and I've got authors from the US as well. But isn't that a powerful statement that information is the currency of democracy? You don't need to tell authors as an editor what to write about, but you set them a challenge and they'll take it on and with surprising results. So being an editor has been a lot of fun, and I continue to do that. I'm really interested in library leadership now, and so I'm pushing that along with my work as a adjunct professor at Charles Sturt University here in Australia.
So that was one of the questions that I wanted to kind of start with that you sort of alluded to a little bit. What do you see a difference between management and leadership? And if so, what is that difference?
Oh, I think there's a whole host of difference between somebody who can manage, and to that extent, that is a step beyond supervision almost, and somebody who understands leadership. And leadership, I think, is where you've been able to bring people along because you may not have all the best ideas, but you're able to listen to your staff, you're able to communicate with your staff, and you're able to then... you know, manage into a future. If you can manage, you know, and I think we've all worked in libraries which are well managed. You know, the walls are well painted, the books, the shelves are well stocked, but they're not leading at all. They're not showing leadership as to where that library should be if it's going to meet the needs of its users. And every library should be pausing, you know, on a regular basis, saying, are we really reflecting the needs of our users? And certainly I've been in libraries where that hasn't been the case. And until you actually turn it around, turn the situation around so that you are meeting that, that's when you're beginning to show leadership. Managing is really, perhaps, in my view, taking the status quo and making sure that the budgets are completed, the positions are filled, the people turn up on time, and services are provided. But you're not leading the library in terms of what those users really want, what they really need. And leadership will also then turn the organization, turn the staff around from what they're doing, which may be very comfortable on a day-to-day basis, and adjusting your services and your profile to meet those needs. So I think we all ought to be good managers, and I've known so many great library managers, but there are fewer, you know, really good leaders. You know, people like your Jim Neal, you know, who used to be at Columbia. You know, he's magnificent, I think, you know, in terms of his articulation of where the library ought to be. Kate Nevins, you know, who was in charge of in the Solinet and then Lyrisis, she too had a tremendous leadership capacity to bring so many libraries along in a consortia to, you know, go to the future. You know, Dwayne Webster from ARL, you know, he did a power of work in establishing CNI within ARL, in terms of establishing leadership programs, both in the US and in Australia. You know, he understood, you know, that this was something that had to happen, and, you know, he had the skills to be able to do it. And so I could go on. You know, there's so many very spectacular, you know, librarians in the US that I've had the pleasure of knowing and working with, as I have with librarians elsewhere in the world.
And of course, Jim Neal is taking over as president of the American Library Association just a few weeks after we have this conversation. So at this year's American Library Association conference. So yeah, I talked to him for the podcast back then too, and yeah, it was we had a lot of good. That's one good thing about the American Library Association is that we always have so many good leaders, and it's sometimes hard to choose between who you want to have as your president. But yeah, he was definitely a good choice. So.
Oh yeah. He'll you know, he'll question her. He'll go with the flow to some extent, but he will he'll question what they're doing. And of course, that needs to happen now. There's so much pressure on libraries, you know, from legislators and people who are quite innocently, naively saying everything is available on the net. And of course, we all know it's not all available on the net. And perhaps the greatest fight that we've won as librarians is to say that access to information is free, you know, through public libraries. And really, access to information is not free. The cost of a public library is very, very steep. Mm-hmm. And if you talk about academic libraries, most people can't get into an academic library. And therefore, if they want to get access to the world's peer-reviewed, published scientific or social science or humanities literature, unless they know somebody, they can't get to it. So the axiom that libraries are free or information is free is something which we need to question and need to be able to deal with. But I wish Jim well doing it.
Yeah, I agree with that too. And that's kind of a thing that's always been something to me is that whenever I try to talk about the services, especially with kind of our community, at my public library is I try to mention that the library is no cost to you at that time, but it is tax supported. So you've kind of already paid for it. So these things are not actually free. They were paid for in a different way. So it don't want to, because if you'd make something say that it's all free, then it makes it worthless. And so, but obviously a lot of this stuff is worth a lot. So.
Oh, that's absolutely true what you say. And it ties back to Jefferson that, you know, it's the currency of democracy. If our people, our peoples cannot get access to that information, and not everybody does want to, but unless they can, then we do get these situations in our media about, you know, the fake news, etc. Because that fake news is not authenticated, it's not peer-reviewed, it's not authoritative. And it's only by getting that, you know, really true and valuable information produced by experts and validated through publishing houses that we can begin to understand where the future might be, and that we can agree with climate science because we can see the evidence instead of just agreeing with something, some opinion somewhere that it's not worth pursuing. So long live Thomas Jefferson, and I say long live Thomas Jefferson.
Yes. you talked about earlier that you had gathered people from kind of around the world to contribute to the book. Can you talk about how you kind of got in touch with them? And was that a goal of yours that you wanted to have like a broad international perspective?
Yeah, yes, I did. I think I ended up with authors from six countries. And I think each of them I knew beforehand, you know, through the journal or other, you know, networking contacts. And, you know, again, I didn't drive what they were to talk about, but I, you know, gave them the title, and they all interpreted that, you know, disruption, management, library management in disruptive times. And so they, you know, talked about Ian Smith, you know, who is an Australian. He's really fantastic about change management, leading change, and he's very inspiring. Bill Fisher from San Jose, you know, he again, he talks about, you know, management and what is a fad and what isn't a fad. Choi Fat Cheong, you know, he was the university librarian at Nanyang in Singapore. A very experienced guy working across the Southeast Asian area countries and very knowledgeable, you know, talking about the laws, the five rules of engagement by Ranganathan, which they're always worth reminding yourself about. Mike Robinson talking about consortia. Petros Kostiliadis, he's talking about, you know, the economic crisis, and he's particularly, he knows a lot about that economic crisis living in Greece, and, you know, they've had a hell of a time, and he talks about the intellectual capital needed, you know, to bring that to the fore. Daniel Forsman talking about the agile principles of management, you know, to really get better value and, you know, most effective change in your library. And Sue Henschel is talking about, you know, professional associations, you know, like we were talking a moment ago with Jim Neal and ALA, you know, people's commitment to professional associations has diminished very, very considerably over the last 10 years or so. Colin Story was a university librarian in Hong Kong, and you know, he's got a disrespectful, cynical view about management, but nevertheless he then moves from that particular position into a position of, you know, how to get the most out of a university library, and he worked at the Chinese University of Hong Kong. And then finally I'm there talking about the meaning of disruption. I'm really trying to get people to become outsiders. There was a an organization in the US, they were a chemical engineering company, and they employed, you know, hordes of PhDs to solve problems, but they were continually coming up against problems that they couldn't solve. And so they put these problems up on a website and said they would pay, you know, XYZ dollars to somebody who can come up with a solution to them. And after a couple of months, finally the first one came in, then the second and third and so on. And so the solutions were being provided to chemical engineering problems, but they were coming from disciplines which were not chemical engineering background. And the point of that is that if you want to solve a problem today, I think it's very important to get outside the box, to get outside your profession, and to look again at what, look afresh at what you've got there. And so if you're an insider, you see the library in this case very much in terms of the rules and very much in terms of the way in which it has operated. But if you become an outsider, you can begin to see the impacts of disruption on content, the impact of disruption on the way in which people, your staff are trained, very much disruptive in terms of, you know, how your users, your academic or your public librarian users, what information they're using and what do they really need. And oftentimes it's not what you are providing. So becoming an outsider in that regard was, you know, very important. But I tried to blend each of these into the book. And, you know, so we talked about the skills and knowledge for an uncertain future. And it is an uncertain future, but, gee, it's exciting. It's exciting because we're in the position where we can really make change, make significant change. And, you know, being an editor, I've come across a lot of fantastic things that are happening in the public libraries in the UK, certainly in a lot of libraries in Australia, libraries in Shanghai and Singapore, etc., and of course in the US. So the book, you know, is an attempt to get so many different perspectives from public librarians, from academic librarians, etc., all over the world in terms of how they see library management in disruptive times.
Yeah, and that's what I try to do a lot on this podcast as well, is to get different points of view, to get public librarians and academic librarians and people from different countries. Even I don't do quite enough of that, but I need to do that a little bit more to get more international people. I think you're the third only not non-American I've had on. I had Jan Holmquist from Denmark and Ned Potter from the UK before, but I need to expand that a lot more. But I do always try to get different perspectives and get even school librarians, for people who are in the younger grades teaching the younger kids as well, just to get those different perspectives, because it's still librarianship, but it's a little bit of what you're talking about, of getting it from the outside. Like a public librarian can learn a lot from an academic librarian and vice versa. Do you find, from what you know about library schools in the U.S., do you find Australian library schools and American library schools generally have the same kind of philosophies, or do you see there's a difference between in the way that you all teach?
I mean, there is a very immediate division that I see, and that's, you know, you've heard of the I schools, I being information schools. They have got on to something, I think, in terms of how is information dealt with, managed, treated, presented in a whole range of disciplines, you know, through a university. So the I schools are a movement, a loose association, if you like, but they're all working within a similar philosophy of library schools in Canada, in Wuhan, China, in Australia, in the US, etc. And so that those schools, I think, are doing some really interesting things in terms of how they're preparing the students, not for traditional libraries, but for a new generation. Their graduates will come into the libraries, and they'll be questioning why this or why that. And I think that is a good school, good idea. I'm involved with developing a Masters of Information Leadership. And one of the characteristics of that course is the fact that I'm aware that libraries and the skills of a librarian are not dissimilar, you know, from what is often termed now GLAM, G-L-A-M. You know, galleries, libraries, archives, and museums. And so I've often seen the need to get people to work collaboratively together. And so we are trying to develop a master's level course on information leadership. And after all, you know, if you're talking a gallery, or you're talking an archives, or a museum, or a library, you are trying to present the kind of information which a user would require. It may be in print, it may be in terms of art galleries or older records in an archives or in a museum. There are all stories to tell, all information to be provided, and how do you do that? And so we're looking at this Masters of Information Leadership, and trying to project it for libraries, most certainly, but trying to also make it relevant, to the GLAM colleagues across the globe, and particularly across Australia and Southeast Asia in the first instance.
And do you have a lot of professional connections throughout the world? I mean, do you know, you talked about Jim Neal and a couple of other American librarians. Do you know some people, other people around the world that you keep in contact with and are inspired by?
Oh yeah. And being a journal editor, you get to meet all kinds of people. People selling their intellectual pursuits and the ideas or perspectives that they have, and it's always very exciting, very interesting to hear what people are thinking and what they're doing and how they're meeting into the challenges they write. And the people I like in this process, in addition, are the reviewers, the peer reviewers. They're a most generous species of people because they give up their time for nothing. They don't get paid by publishers, and yet the only instructions I have to them is be gentle on the authors and help them to the finishing line if we can possibly help them there. But a peer reviewer has a lot of wisdom to impart in terms of helping people write and get across. And so I've been very privileged in my career to, meet people right across Europe and right across the globe. I'm working on another book with a European colleague from Finland on print repositories, and we're looking at how repositories and how they're organized to preserve the print record, because there is no way in that all the print that has been published in the world is digital now or will ever be digital. And so how do we make that available? How do we preserve it? How do we deal with the problems? And that's a very interesting connection as well. But I said at the beginning of the interview, I came to be a librarian by personal circumstance, but I've never regretted it. It's been an absolutely phenomenal career, and it continues to be.
Well, to wrap up, do you have any last advice for listeners about how, I mean, obviously they should read your book to find out about all this, but any specific advice about how libraries can manage themselves in disruptive times and how we can, because I think we probably both agree that we think libraries have an opt we're optimistic about the future of libraries, but it is disruptive and it does feel sort of like constant change all the time. Do you have advice for people who are kind of feeling that
Oh, the only
churn
advice.
almost?
Oh, this is my own point of view, but I mean, always I think two things. One is engage with your users as much as you possibly can, and bring your users into the planning. You may think that users don't know anything about libraries, but they're very interested in libraries. They're very interested, and they have a lot of things to contribute. And number two, really come up, do not settle on one scenario, one future, but really come up with at least three different futures for your organization and put them out to your users. Trust your users, trust your users as your users trust the concept and the practice of a library. Because libraries are trusted organizations, and we ought to, in reverse, offer scenarios to our users, which they can in turn comment on and really help give ownership to new futures. But if you can let a number of futures sit on the table for a number of months, drawing comments from a range of your users, it will gain you a lot of engagement, a lot of engagement in the future of the library. Wēlei tuši guam is what I say, the future of the libraries. And it can be gained through your many scenarios and through engagement with your users. So I guess that's the simple advice that I would offer.
Well, if any listeners wanted to follow up with you, do you have a way that they could, a simple way that they could contact you?
My email is probably the best way. I've got a website there for Information Exponentials, which is my little company that I work with now. But my email address is ocostevee@gmail.com. ocostevee@gmail.com. I'd be very glad to talk to people.
All right, well, Steve, thank you so much for talking to me, and thanks for being on the show.
And thank you for running such a great program.
Thank you.
Okay, good night.
Circulating Ideas is produced by Steve Thomas in the suburbs of Atlanta, with support from the University of South Carolina School of Library and Information Science and from listeners like you. Find out how you can help support the show by going to circulatingideas.com and clicking on support. Help others find the show by subscribing, rating, and reviewing the show at Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Overcast, or your podcast app of choice. Follow the show on Twitter at CircIdeas or the show's Facebook page. Our music is by Pamela Klicka. Thank you for listening, and keep circulating your ideas.
It's always nice talking from a Steve to a Steve.
Yes, the Two Steves podcasts.